Go ahead and have a seat.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency to order. Today we're going to start at the top of the list and then we'll jump around a little bit. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2555. And is that the one that Gorsuch signed up for?
I believe on 2955.
Okay, if I didn't say it right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2955.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for kicking off our committee today. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch, State Representative for House District 49, which includes the cities of Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and Gresham. I'm glad to be here this afternoon to speak in support of House Bill 2955, which will help make certain that we are taking the steps needed to ensure that taxpayers' money is being spent in a responsible manner by government agencies. In the 2009 legislation was passed to increase accountability for taxpayers' money. A key piece of that legislation was requiring most public employers to complete a feasibility study when they intended to contract out services over $250,000. After completing the study, if it showed that it was less expensive to provide the service using in-house personnel, the work would not be contracted out. However, there are continuing instances where this legislation is apparently not being followed and no enforcement mechanism exists to compel agencies who do not comply with the legislation to do so. For instance, the City of Wilsonville chose to contract out wastewater treatment services without completing the legally feasible required feasibility study. These services could have been done in-house. And for less money, but there was no course of action available, even though they had ignored the law. Our agencies do important work, and they do it well, but taxpayer-funded agencies have a responsibility to ensure that their funds are spent wisely. So House Bill 2955 will help ensure this sort of thing by creating the enforcement mechanism needed to guarantee that legally required feasibility studies are completed. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and kicking us off on this bill. Any questions for you directly? We have several other testifiers I'm sure can answer questions as well. Representative Johnson, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Representative, appreciate you being here, too. And I'll follow up with some of the folks that will be behind you, I'm sure. But in regards to holding public agencies accountable for having a process of determining whether, in fact, they can find, more affordable means to provide public services, i.e., in this case, you referenced the city. My perspective is from the school district perspective and so forth. But I would just say, in regards to the city of Wilsonville, you have, I'm guessing, a city council, right?
I believe so.
There must be a mayor. We were all duly elected individuals.
Right.
Wouldn't the check and balance about whether they're acting in the public's best interest be the ballot box? If, in fact, the city is making, decisions that were not in the economic best interest of its constituents?
No, you raise a good point. I mean, there is always the possibility for elected officials to be recalled. Absolutely. However, I would argue that even though the mechanism is there, recalling people is a fairly arduous task, relatively expensive. But it is definitely a possibility, too, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. Have a good day.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your testimony today. Up next, I have Tricia Smith, Cindy Drought, and Sarah Drescher.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. So one is missing.
Good afternoon.
Permanently.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. First, I'd like to say that our field representative from Southern Oregon, Cindy Drought, is somewhere between here and Medford. I know that she left there early this morning. I do not know where she is at this moment. If she arrives, I hope she can join us. If she does not arrive, I've submitted to you Cindy's written testimony, and I will briefly summarize it for her.
Okay, thank you. I hope she's driving the speed limit.
Of course she is, Representative. Of course. And, in fact, that's a good segue, because obeying the law is what we should all be doing. And that brings us to House Bill 2955. House Bill 2955 is a bill which we did not introduce, but which we wholeheartedly support. We have a bill very similar to it in the Senate, which accomplishes much of the same thing that this bill does. That's Senate Bill 805. This bill was brought to you as a result of a long, long process that we've been involved in with regard to contracting out services that are normally provided by employees of government. That's school districts, cities, counties, the state governments, taxpayer-supported government. We, on your desk, or provided to you today, are summaries of three studies that OSEA contracted with the University of Oregon to produce to look at the issue of contracting of services to determine whether or not contracts actually save money as they were purported to save when they were first let. Our interest in this is obvious. We represent school bus drivers, cooks, custodians, folks like that in educational institutions, and many of their jobs have been contracted out in the past because school officials believed that they were going to be saving money by doing so. So we contracted with the University of Oregon to look at the question of whether or not districts actually did save money in those contracts. They have produced three studies for us. The first was in 2004, the next in 2008, and the last was last week. The first two studies proved without question that not only do these contracts not save money, they cost a great deal of money, and once they have been let, they cannot be unlet. Because as you see, when a school district contracts out student transportation, for example, one of the reasons they may do that is because they are being offered a lot of money for their buses. They can use that money to fill the budget hole that exists for, well, you choose the year, and I'll tell you what the reason was. They didn't get the money they needed for schools. We certainly understand the pain of the budget. However, we want decisions to be that are based on short-term budget issues to be decisions that we can live with the long-term. And these contracts are not decisions we can live with, because once a district, in my example, student transportation, contracts out student transportation, they can't very easily bring it back. Their buses are gone. They cost millions to replace. So they're stuck with a contractor. And believe me, the contractors know it. And our studies show that those subsequent contracts cost more and more money over the years. That's why the legislature in 2009 passed House Bill 2867, which required all government agencies letting contracts to essentially know how much it's going to cost them before they buy it, and to compare that cost with the cost of doing the service themselves. Cindy is here.
Sorry, couldn't find parking. I know you're surprised by that.
It took almost as long to find parking as it is to get there. So the legislature passed 2867, requiring a cost-benefit analysis. That is something that state auditors tell me that they would tell an agency to do just as a matter of doing business, because it's important. When I'm running my household, I want to know how much something costs before I buy it. Sometimes I don't, but I try to. So the cost-benefit analysis requirement was passed into the legislature. So we've had 4 years since then to deal with this law and see how it worked. And the third study that LIRC did was to tell you what happened. The first district to try to contract out in our world was Central Point. And that's why Cindy is here, to talk to you about what happened in Central Point and how that conflicts with the intention of the legislature and how it shows the problems with the way House Bill 2867 was written and why the improvements in 2955 are so important.
Thank you, and welcome.
Thank you.
And introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, for the record, my name is Cindy Drought. I'm a field representative with Oregon School Employees Association. Chair Holby and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I represent the classified employees in Central Point School District, and up until 2011, that also included school bus drivers and bus mechanics. I'm here today to speak in support of HB 2955. When the Oregon legislature passed HB 2867 in 2009, it was believed the law would provide a level of transparency and accountability to a public employer who intended to contract out work normally and customarily performed by public employees. Having experienced firsthand the implementation of this law in Central Point, I can attest that the transparency and accountability the legislature hoped to achieve does not exist. HB 20.
Cindy, if you could try to summarize a little bit, because
okay.
We can read your written testimony.
Okay.
So I'm trying to save a little bit of time. I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
I know you're not used to probably doing
I'm not,
this,
Cindy, so I appreciate your patience.
Okay.
In Central Point School District, the cost analysis that was completed as part of the law was not done correctly. There were things that were missing from that, and there were things that were misleading in it. And even when we had attempted to bring some of those things to light to the district still went ahead and approved contracting out of transportation services. One of the things that this law is attempting to do is to ensure that there be an information request so that districts can get a full picture of what an outside contractor would cost. That has been a problem in the past with Central Point because for a student who was the contractor considered that information proprietary. What resulted in that, and I will just use the example of the labor costs because you will hear from, I believe, Professor Lafer from the University of Oregon who can explain more about the problems. But for labor costs alone, because the district could not get full information from First Student on their labor costs, they did them as cost neutral. So basically what the district cost for personnel and transportation, they believed First Student also would. We know that that's not correct because personnel costs for a company like First Student are substantially less, especially in the areas of health benefits and retirement benefits. If the district had done a proper cost analysis and had actual numbers, I don't believe that the district would have been able to show the cost savings that was needed to contract out. And what that would have resulted in would have been 35 school bus drivers remaining in the district. The district had a third of those drivers with 10-plus years of experience. We had two with over 25 years of experience. One driver was not hired by the contractor, and Ms. Drescher may have already spoken about this employee. She has filed litigation against the district and First Student because the cost analysis was faulty. But this was a driver who'd been active in the union, was a long-term bus driver. She used to talk in very glowing terms about the kids she used to transport, especially kids who had invited her to their graduation and even to their weddings. There was a bond there. Also, you would have about 35 bus drivers who would retain their insurance. Right now, based on Professor Lafer's study, the people that he interviewed showed that none of the people interviewed could take advantage of First Student's insurance because it was too costly for them to do that. I know, having worked with these drivers for 3 years before they were contracted out, that there were some who had health issues or that their families had health issues. How they met those needs without that insurance, I don't know. And the other would be drivers who also would still be in the PERS system. I know there's a lot of discussion about PERS right now. And just to get it in perspective, the second most senior driver was about 25 years with the district. She was making about $20,000 a year when she was contracted out. I recently, in another district, had an employee who was a 26-year veteran educational assistant. She retired last year, and she's getting about $900 a month in her PERS. So the group that we're talking about here are not employees who are getting that $40,000 to $100,000 a month for PERS. So it was a significant amount for them to be able to have that. They no longer have that. I believe that HB 2955 also provides the ability for the employee group's exclusive representative to be able to intervene if we feel that there's a problem. Had we done that, had we had the ability to do that, then the employee who was not hired, who is filing the litigation, would not have had to be put in that position. She had to seek work, and it took her several months to find work. When she ultimately did, she had to move out of county with her family still in Jackson County. She would have been able to stay in her job and stay in the area. This law is not prohibiting a public employer from contracting out. But what it will do is provide that transparency and that accountability that was the original intent of the law. And so I do encourage you to consider the changes that are being proposed. I think that it will meet the original intent. It will give even districts and other public employers the tools they need to make a decision on how best to utilize public funds.
Thank you very much. If you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. And
sure thing. My name is Sarah Drescher. I'm an attorney in Oregon. I represent labor unions, private and public sector. And I'm the attorney handling that litigation. I've spent the last 2 years in the Jackson County Circuit Court and now in the Oregon Court of Appeals right around the corner dealing with compliance over the current law. And I feel I'm intimately familiar with both the good things about the law and areas it needs improvement. And I'm here today to express my support for the changes to the law that are presented by House Bill 2955. I won't spend a lot of time talking about the legislative intent, but as probably one of the few people who has sat there and listened to every single hearing from 2009 on this law, I can tell you that the legislators wanted to know where the money is being spent by the private contractor. Okay? The research presented that Tricia has given to you today said, you know, in the long term, we might not be spending public funds the best. Private contractors might actually be ripping us off. So let's figure out where they're spending the funds. And that was their intent in creating the original cost analysis provisions, not to prohibit contracting out, but to ensure there were cost savings and that cost savings weren't simply achieved by slashing health insurance, by slashing retirement, and by putting people in minimum wage. They wanted to find efficiencies in privatization. And what I've given to you today is a cost analysis completed by the Central Point School District. That is the basis for the litigation that has made my life quite less fun in the last 2 years. And what you'll see, I think, just by looking at that, is that the Central Point School District, in their defense, was one of the first public agencies to attempt compliance and didn't really know how to comply. But what you find there, if you look on the right-hand side of the page, is the estimated cost for the contractor. And you see there that the district wrote in the first, you know, average actual salary and wage and benefits costs, the district can't determine the wages and benefit programs because we haven't done any RFPs. And for the material costs, they were supposed to estimate the private contractor's material costs, and they say, well, we don't know. And it says, quote, because we can't estimate the exact cost of materials for a contractor until we get actual numbers, no, we're going to use this assumption that they're going to save 10%. And then if you look down further in the miscellaneous cost section, there's nothing. It's an empty space. And if you turn to the next page, they're supposed to include the profit incurred by the contractor or anything not in the above. Again, there's more empty spaces. This does not achieve the legislative intent of trying to figure out where the money's going, how it's being spent, and ensuring cost savings. Now, what House Bill 2955 does is it solves the major problem that the Central Point School District had. because it requires that before you do this cost analysis, before you create this form you see in front of you, you have to find the information you need. You have to issue information requests, and you have to go through a fact and information gathering process where you find out from the private contractor, what do you spend on parts? What are you going to pay your employees? You know, how are you going to find the efficiencies to make this cost effective? And the law says they've got to do that before they enter into this cost analysis. And I think that solves a major gaping hole. And it's good not only for us, the unions and the employees, it's good for Central Point. It's good for public agencies to be able to know that they have a process in place in the law that says, here's how you get that information, here's when you need to get it, and here's how you need to use it. So the changes by House Bill 2955 are good for everyone. The other major part that would have saved me a lot more free time in the last 2 years is that it has a mechanism to resolve disputes, and that's through a writ of review process with the circuit court. Right now, there is no remedial process for violations of these cost analysis provisions. And that's one of the issues in the litigation I've been having. And one of the reasons we're in the appellate court right now is because there is no mechanism. And we need a fast and efficient mechanism, because if they want to contract out, they need an answer quickly. And if we think there's a problem, we need to be able to raise it quickly. So what House Bill 2955 does as well is it provides a writ of review process so that employees, unions, contractors can all bring issues to court speedily and get these issues resolved. There are a few other changes, and I know we're short on time, so I'll end it there, but I do encourage you to pass this House bill. I think it is good for our communities as well as our employees and our public agencies. Thank you.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, I'm not sure if I heard it. Does Central Point still own its school buses?
No, they sold them as part of the process. So First Student now owns their school buses.
I've got a very quick question, and it's on Mr. Out on your testimony. On the back page, talking about retirement, is this a typo, or it said that the First Student would match their 401ks up to $250 a year? Is that a year or a month?
That is a year.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm also curious, do you know, does Central Point charge does contractor for Central Point, who I guess owns the school buses or bought school buses, do they charge for the replacement of those school buses or those new school buses?
That's a great question. So as you probably know, the state of Oregon reimburses school districts for 70% of their approved transportation costs. So the school district still gets reimbursement from the state of Oregon, which they use to pay under their contract to First Student for some of those approved transportation costs. Now part of it, and you've got a lot of literature in front of you, part of what the LIRC research had found was whether this was ethically sound. Because at the same time, and you'll read in this report, First Student is using the school buses for private enterprises. And one of the things they were doing was doing casino tours, using the buses for casino tours. And so the research raised by the LIRC report, the most recent one, you know, questioned whether, you know, this money that still gets reimbursement from the state and it gets funneled through the district to the private contractor, you know, whether that's ethically sound given that the buses are now being used for private purposes, unrelated entirely to the transportation of students. Did you want to add something to that?
Tricia Smith again. Mr. Chair, I only wanted to point out to you that I've provided, I think in your offices you have copies of the full LIRC report, and what I provided to you today was his conclusions and also Dr. Lafer's point-by-point analysis of the major points within that study. And it talks about school bus purchases under the contract in there, and talks about the questionable practices that districts find themselves the recipient of.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We've got a pretty long agenda, so I'd like to get Alana Guinea and Andy Boger. Probably said that wrong. Good afternoon. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record and hopefully not repeat what you've already heard.
Okay. My name is Andy Boger. I'm a researcher with SEIU Local 503.
Go ahead and give us your testimony. Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I'm here to testify in support of HB 2259. I didn't hear quite all of the previous testimony, so I'm just going to, but I am going to be pretty brief. ORS 279B was amended in 2009 to require some public contracting agencies to compare the anticipated cost to contract out with the cost to perform the work in-house for contracts worth $250,000 or more. As you heard previously, these feasibility studies help local governments and state government agencies use scarce resources more efficiently in order to assure that they don't waste money on unneeded contracts. Unfortunately, as you just heard, no public entity has enforcement authority, and no public entity or private party may bring legal action to compel compliance with this law. HB 2955 allows employees or their union to the right to seek judicial review when public contracting agencies fail to comply with the provisions of 279B.030, .033, and .036. Unfortunately, there have been cases in which employers have not performed the feasibility study when the law required them to do so. The city of Wilsonville, for example, contracted out operation of its wastewater treatment plant without performing a feasibility study. A law that cannot be enforced has at best limited value. For this reason, we are urging passage of HB 2955. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here on behalf of the 250,000 members of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today. I don't want to repeat the details and history that you've already heard. I will say that our organization was very involved in the creation of the original bills that led to a review of contracts before they were contracted out. We represent members in both the public and private sector. Presumably, our members could hold these jobs through the agencies or school districts or other local bodies that originally provided the work, or through the contractors that might receive a contract later. But this bill to us is really about ensuring that our laws work as intended, as your body intended them when they were originally passed, and that we're not wasting the limited resources that we have as a state and as local communities on bad deals. And right now we see holes in the original policies that allow contractors to come in and write what may originally be a good deal but ultimately ends up being a bad deal for our communities. We want to prevent that from happening. We wholeheartedly support this bill. We think that it is good policy for Oregon, and we encourage your aye votes. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have Brian Smith, Scott Winkles, and Lori Satinspiel.
You going to take questions? Are you going to allow some questions, panels?
Did you have a question?
I didn't hear anything. Previous two, but I can... I'll sum it up later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you'll have another opportunity. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Smith. I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County. In 2009, the proponents of the feasibility and cost analysis legislation made well-intentioned claims about how these requirements would work in terms of preserving jobs from indiscriminate outsourcing by public agencies. The original text of this particular law came from statutes that have been passed and in effect for some time in both Michigan and California. At the time of the work sessions, proponents acknowledged that they had no idea how well it was or wasn't working in those states, accomplishing the stated goals. Their intent was to just try it out and see how it works. We now have 3 years of experience with this law in Oregon, and I would like to talk to you about my experience as someone who has implemented these provisions and can speak firsthand to how it works. The summary is that the feasibility and cost analysis requirements result in plenty of additional bureaucracy and no demonstrated benefit to Multnomah County. I believe this is classic red tape, and the changes proposed by HB 2955 simply heap additional requirements on public agencies. Here's some of the facts about the last 3 years. In Multnomah County, we've had 25 projects subject to these requirements. We've only done one cost analysis, and that was for fleet maintenance services, a project which was never procured because we combined these services with another government. Multnomah County procures primarily services, and a lot of the client services which we are exempt from the provisions of this law. Many staff are confused about this law's applicability to their procurements, and I tend to see staff err on going through the process of completing their completing the documentation rather than risk being out of compliance with this law. On average, it takes about 3 hours of staff time to create and review each of these forms. And on average, I spend about 16 hours a year on the quarterly reporting to my local contract review board about these projects that the law requires. My experience is that the feasibility and cost analysis requirement adds both time and cost to our procurement processes, but not value. Regarding HB 2955, there are three sections which stand out as particularly problematic. First, estimating the profit of potential contractors would realize depends on so many factors outside of the control of the contracting agency. For example, a contractor's size, their debt load, their employee productivity, that this would be no better than guessing. This section is impractical and should be amended out. Second, this bill would prevent excluding proceeds or revenues from a sale or long-term capital or other assets in the cost analysis. I would argue that this is a one-sided provision and that it precludes the contracting agency from determining what is the highest and best use of its assets and using that information in the decision to move forward with a procurement or not. Third, I believe the provisions for judicial review, which are included in this bill, would increase the likelihood that critical projects would experience delay due to litigation. All of these provisions were features of the original legislation, and they didn't pass muster then. It's not been my experience that indiscriminate outsourcing of public services is a problem. The feasibility and cost analysis requirements currently in statute have added additional bureaucracy and made our public procurement processes less efficient over time when we're doing our best to provide greater efficiencies for taxpayers. We have 3 years of experience with these requirements in Oregon, and I believe that that experience demonstrates that the provisions of this bill are both unnecessary and counterproductive. For those who would advocate for them, I would challenge them to bring data from the last 3 years, beyond one or two examples, which shows the need for these provisions and not simply more of, let's try this and see how it works. Thank you once again for your time, and I'd be happy to address any questions.
Go ahead,
Lori. Lori Satins for the Oregon School Boards, Mr. Chair. I'm here in opposition today to House Bill 2955. I, too, was a part of the original 2867 bill that passed in the 09 session. I was also a part of the work group to try to implement that bill, to figure out how we need to do the feasibility study, how we need to go about with the cost analysis. It's been a challenge. We've got one district who opted to do the feasibility study and go forward with a cost analysis, Central Point. They followed the process, determined that they could save costs, and they contracted out. Now that case is in court. The lower court has determined the district did do the cost analysis correctly, and now it's on appeal. I asked the Central Point to give me some costs that they've incurred already for this analysis or for the slowdown in the legal fees. Right now, we're estimated at $160,000 that they've spent to say that their decision was correct based on the law. You know, at First Student hired back the bus drivers. And I hear that there's one that wasn't. You know, and part of this, the cost analysis piece is that was mentioned previous was we're asking for cost before we actually ask for procurement. So it's a little hard to guess at these things. So we have very, very capable business officials. You've got their hands tied when they can't look at the entire best business practice of how to contract out for services, including all of the costs. This bill further limits what we can compare to, which doesn't seem like a very good operations in a district when we've got scarce resources and trying to use them efficiently. So again, I'm here in opposition to 2955. Happy to answer questions.
Scott?
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. It was my duty to represent the League in the work group on the legislation from 2009. I remember three committees in two chambers, multiple hours on the third floor in various very hot and stuffy conference rooms, trying to negotiating and developing the language on this bill. And I also remember the implementation conversations that took place. I think one of the League's chief concerns with this legislation is that we are talking about negotiated language. Everybody showed up in 2009 in good faith to talk about to do our best to come up with a bill that was could be implemented, and now we're revisiting the issue, asking to put in language the negotiation work group took out. So my somewhat rhetorical question is, what is the League's incentive to negotiate on issues in the future, mm-hmm. if we're only going to revisit the results of those negotiations later on? That is the long-term health of these relationships, and should be of a concern to all parties. Additionally, there are a couple of other points I want to bring up about the problems with implementing this bill. Last session, the legislature determined and actually prohibited local governments and state agencies from discussing costs with certain types of contractors when procuring A&E architect and engineering services. So now we're being asked to project a cost while the legislature has said we cannot discuss costs when procuring an architect or an engineer, and we have to make that hiring decision based solely on qualifications. Whether that is panned out in the public interest is a conversation for a different day that we'd really like to have. But the trying to square those two requirements seems difficult. Additionally, the issues with projecting costs based on prior to issuing the procurement for services, the contracting agencies stated in that work group, and if I recall correctly, on the record and testimony, that it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get that information as was required in the 2009 bill. With that, I think I'm going to close my testimony. I'll be eager for your questions.
Questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, would it be your opinion, let's say, that this bill would simply tighten the scrutiny around contracting out for services, or would it, in effect, eliminate it altogether as a possibility for public agencies, as a practical possibility?
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, it will certainly make contracting out of services more difficult, and one of our concerns is that if a city does go through with the process, they do the cost analysis or the feasibility study as required from the 2009 legislation, and the determination is we're going to contract out, then I think from the bargaining perspective, the incentive is simply to go all in, mm-hmm. and file a suit and roll the dice. That would be our concern.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And just, I guess, some comments here. You know, we've heard that this bill would be good for the employee groups who have testified on behalf of that. We've heard from the bargaining units representing the employee groups that they believe it would be in their best interest as well. But as a school board member, one group that hasn't been mentioned here is kids. And as a school board member, it's my obligation to try to use the state school support we receive as well as we can to be able to provide the best quality education we possibly can for the students that we are constitutionally required to provide a free and appropriate education. And in doing so, we make all kinds of decisions each and every month about what's the best way to use those taxpayer resources we have. And there are times we make estimations that, you know, this would save us some money here because we can protect that classroom environment. We can make sure class sizes are as low as they possibly can. We provide the best quality education we possibly can for the kids that we're elected to serve. And I think it's just, I guess, unfortunate that we haven't been recognizing who are these agencies, who are these boards, who are these city councils, who are these county commissioners really elected to serve. And it's the people that elect them. And in my case, it's the people who want us to be able to provide the best quality education we possibly can for our students. So from my perspective, as a school board member who's also trying to help this state achieve 40-40-20, this is not going to help us. It's not going to help us do our business. It's not going to help us operate as efficiently as possibly can. It's not going to help us to increase access and affordability for education. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your question. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2955, and I'm going to open. Sam Harker is here.
Yes.
So I'm going to open up a couple of these bills here. I'm going to open up concurrently House Bill 3258, 3328, and 3329. Representative Harker, did you also want to testify on 3360?
Mr. Chair, I will be happy to do so if that seems appropriate. If you'd like to open up all four of them at the same time, feel free.
Okay, we'll go ahead and open up House Bill 3360. These are information technology bills, and after we're done with those bills, we will move to the 3160 and 2525 before we get into transparency. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thanks for the reminder, Mr. Chair. I often forget to do so when I'm
always
here. I am Chris Harker, representing House District 34, which is Beaverton, Cedar Hill, Cedar Mills, etc. Thank you for having me here today and for opening a hearing on these three bills. I guess four. So the three that I have brought reflect my background and my experience in the building. And because those are really germane, I want to spend just a couple of minutes on them, okay? Before coming here for 16 years, and for the first 3 years that I served in this building in this capacity, I was running a software business for researchers such as I had been before, and then at the end for entire universities, little organizations like UCLA, George Washington University. And what we did was provide software to those universities to interface with the 26 federal granting agencies. So this company grew to be 26 people in Beaverton hosting data and services for about 120 universities and research hospitals around the country at the time that I sold the business a year ago. I can now speak freely. I have no financial connection with the daily activities of that business. I was assigned to the General Government Subcommittee of Ways and Means when I first came here, which, as several of you know, covers entities including the State Data Center. I was really looking forward to the first meeting where we heard about the State Data Center, thinking that I might be able to understand what was going on in there, given the context, my training and experience in the outside world. And when I came in, I was surprised and a bit dismayed at what I learned about the level of integration and delivery of functionality to the agencies that were relying upon the data center. Despite the best of intentions of everyone involved, I want to talk to you about the data center, about the processes we use to manage, acquire, deliver data operations to our state agencies and the people in the public who we support by doing so, and make a case for some significant change in the way we do things. I also want to think about how this body, not just this committee, but the legislative body, is charged with overseeing those activities and make the case that I don't think we can adequately do it. All right? After my committee assignment, general government, I served with others, including Representative Vice Chair Richardson here, on an IT work group for a while where we learned more. We issued a report. We banged our heads against walls. We tried to find paths whereby we could supervise some of these IT projects. In the last session, I was co-chair with Representative Thatcher, unfortunately not here, of the Joint Legislative Committee on Audits and Information Management and Technology, where we heard more about the successes and the shortcomings of different programs in IT. The problem continued to come into focus from my perspective, and I think that I've been very frustrated. I had hoped, based on my experience in small businesses and in the research world, that we would be able to look at a problem, learn as much as we could about it, and fix it. Or say, wow, this is really great. Let's take this approach and apply it across multiple iterations and deliver really good services. Been unable to do that. Could be just me.
And to the bill.
To the bills. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. You do have a very big docket. So what I'm going to do, I'll fast forward. But in my humble opinion, we do not have the capacity in this building to oversee IT. We do not have the capacity as a state to deliver world-class functionality. And we really should rely more on the private sector. Not for everything, but for some things. Supporting arguments include today's outage of the phone system, as it was on day one of the session. Comments I heard from the staff in the building said, sure wish we could get out of that system and use some things from the private sector. In the state data center, there is a refreshment rate on servers, which is far longer than in the private sector. That forces agencies that are using it to use outdated equipment. We also paint our employees into corners. One of the activities that I was able to do and perform in my current function, along with Representative Kotek, was to visit the DHS APD, that's Aging and People with Disabilities office in Beaverton, where the employees were on the verge of tears trying to use the outdated computers, software, and really minimal bandwidth that they had available to them. They could not serve their customers well. We have an astonishing number of downtime outages at the state data center in comparison with that which is in the private sector. We paint the employees into a corner, and my recommendations in these three bills are basically that we change the way we manage IT, we change the way we do IT business, and then we change the way the state data center runs and honestly shrink its role in terms of what it's delivering. HB 3258 would create the Governor's Office of Information Technology and have the Chief Information Officer of the state have real power and ability to coordinate resources and facilities and deployments of programs across state agencies. House Bill 3328 is about the procurement of IT, and it would address the fact that there are agencies which sometimes want to go procure services from the private sector and are unable to do so because of our current rules. And 3329 would create a board for the state data center to oversee it. That board would consist of a mix of private sector and public sector people. I don't think we have more time to go into those bills right here, right now, based on what I'm seeing and hearing. I am certainly willing to do so. But what I am trying to do here is change our model of overseeing IT. I know a fair amount about it. I can really easily make people's eyes glaze over in conversations like this. You folks are looking pretty good and attentive, and I really appreciate that. If there were 30 people with that background in this building, I think we still couldn't oversee everything because of everything else that we have to oversee. We need to create a structure, and I think we can do it without a big fiscal, because we can move people around from different assignments. And we can create a structure that will have the authority, the power, and the responsibility for overseeing projects of all different size and scope and budget.
Thank you. And Representative Vega Peterson, I know that, would you like to testify on these bills as well?
I would be glad to.
Thank you.
Come on down.
So as you know, Representative Harker has given us a pretty good background of the issues and a quick overview of the individual bills. So we're really kind of looking for what are these bills going to do for us.
Thank you. So Chair Holvey,
identify yourself for the record.
Yes, too. Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I represent House District 47, which is the city of Portland east of Interstate 205. So Representative Parker has done a great job kind of giving the background and the need from his perspective. I'm going to speak today really solely on 3360. That's the bill I'm most familiar with. However, I do applaud his efforts in taking a look at this very important issue for our state government, all the agencies that use the IT systems, and I support him in the efforts to see what we can do in fixing some of the issues that we're facing today. So the 3360, the bill has actually completely been changed. There's an amendment that actually it's a gut and stuff, but a friendly gut and stuff that really gives more detail in what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. You should have the amendment in front of you now. So like Representative Harker, my background is also in computers and technology. I've worked for 14 years in the industry, working for everything from small startups to large companies. Most recently, I worked at Microsoft, where I worked in project management in unified communications, which is web conferencing, instant messaging, and corporate presence. But in all of the positions that I've had, I've always helped companies find solutions to their business problems through the use of technology. And I think that's something, a perspective that I'm bringing here today to take a look at how the people that we served in our different agencies, in our different departments, how we can serve them best using technology, and do we have the systems in place to do that well. So House Bill 3360 is a start at doing this. The scope of that is not as large as some of the things that Representative Harker is doing. What it does is set up an Office of Shared Technology Services, the intent of which is for this team to bring expertise that are right now dispersed across a lot of different agencies into one team. And this team would act, I call it the ninja team, but it would act as a center of expertise for our agencies, especially those small to medium-sized agencies. They don't have the budget or the personnel to really accomplish this on their own. Its goal is to provide technical advice, provide assistance in either developing or acquiring the technology services that our agencies need. You're going to hear about, you already heard about some of these bills. I look forward to working with Representative Harker and you moving forward on finding the best shape for these to take. But this is a really urgent problem for us to face, and I think it's something that we need to address this session. So thank you.
Thank you very much for that overview, and I know we're going to get probably more opportunity to get into the specifics of the bills once we get amendments and that. Questions for the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a Ways and Means where it's always a co-chair. Mr. Chair, I really appreciate you allowing this conversation to occur as a representative who's served on Ways and Means for decades. That's kind of scary. This is really, really becoming a critical issue for the state of Oregon. If we had our joint committee on Ways and Means General Government here, I think they would be expressing the same interest in trying to figure out how do we get our arms around this. We're blessed in that we have Michael Jordan, Mr. Jordan from DAS, who's just phenomenal in trying to work with us to solve this problem. But what I want to get on the record just very quickly is we're dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of IT projects that are being spent. And the reality is we've got two members of the legislative body who are knowledgeable and versed. You've got folks like me who have trouble turning on my computer, who are holding a gavel, who are overseeing general government and overseeing these IT projects. And at some point in time, this legislative body has to get its arms around this specialty. Technology is not going away. The cost is not going away. And we've got to figure out how to do this correctly. And so I just really applaud you for allowing this conversation to occur. And I hope this is the first of many. And I hope at some point we'll have DAS and your committee and Ways and Means all talking together in one forum. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony today. And I want to get Michael Jordan up here next. Thank you very much for bringing this and working on this. It is, as Representative Smith has alluded to, a big issue that we need to look at and see if we can figure out what to do next.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Michael Jordan, please. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, and we don't have time for your half-hour presentation that you wanted to give us today, but we will invite you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state. I also am the Director at the Department of Administrative Services. I will abbreviate my comments today, and we can get into them in more detail later. Let me say to all of you that I am supportive of the intent of all four of these bills. I think we have some discussion around exactly how we get at that intent, the mechanisms that we use. But I wanted to, for the sake of the committee, just brief context to let you know that the environment is not static in state government. We are attempting to make some changes in how we govern, how we manage, and to IT specifically, I couldn't agree more. We now have a fairly substantial amount of data that we've gathered in the last 6 months regarding kind of our internal service provision, benchmarked ourselves against our peer states, and benchmarked ourselves against world-class service delivery. That some of that information is up on OLIS for you to examine yourself if you wish. But the story that we see from that data is that we are extremely fragmented in our approach to IT governance, and that we need to get our head around how we're going to do a better job at providing those services. I want you to know that my job specifically, and I'm being held accountable by the governor, to get after these issues. And so if I'm not here next time you meet, it will be because I haven't made progress on these issues. I have convened a group of agency heads, which probably represent about 95% of state government spend in the executive branch, and we have formed an enterprise leadership team that is designed to get at these issues. My approach to change management in state government is that the only way we're going to get beyond the weebies, that means folks who say we be here when you be gone, and I'm about the sixth person in 10 years to sit in my chair, and so that perspective by certain folks in state government is probably legitimate and rational. But to get beyond that, the way we have to approach state government is to get state government to change itself. And that's a combination of the use of authority and the use of engagement with folks and getting them their heads around these problems and trying to attack them. That enterprise leadership team is charged with doing that at my behest. We have a number of projects where we are already working on some of the smaller aspects of information technology, and we are going to make progress on those. The things that have been brought up today are big structural issues about how we do technology with these bills. As to House Bill 3258, the CIO, I am fully supportive of trying to establish the role, responsibility, and authority of the Chief Information Officer in statute. We are one of only 8 states where that is not the case, and so I'm fully supportive of working with you to try and do that. One of the things we have suffered from in the past is that that authority and responsibility of the Chief Information Officer has been ambiguous, and where it has been clear, not always followed. And so that's a function of leadership. It's also a function of culture. And we need to figure out a way to make that clearer in the way we do business. House Bill 3328, on the other hand, looks at giving agencies more freedom to reduce their costs by contracting with the private sector. Believe me, I am fully supportive of us trying to reduce our costs, and if the tool to do that is to contract certain functions, I'm fine with that, and we should be looking at those things. However, to give state agencies that authority to do that tends to lead to even further fragmentation of the delivery of these services. And then, so there's a dilemma for us to resolve in how we implement that intent to get the lowest cost and the best product, if you will, for state agencies. House Bill 3329, again, I am fully supportive of the intent, but I want to say to you, we have already made a change at DAS in the last year to implement a customer board for the state data center. That board is chartered by me. That board has full authority to set service levels, to set rate methodologies, to set the rates that agencies pay for those services, to review and approve the strategic business plan for the data center. And so I believe we at least have something that looks like what Representative Harker wants to accomplish. We can talk more about the logistics and authority and how that works, but we have already created something at least that I think we should talk about in that sense. And then lastly, House Bill 3360, I think the idea, and I'll use my own terms, the idea of some kind of internal consulting service that can provide boards and commissions and state agencies with expert service in real time as they need it, focused on the problem they're actually trying to solve, I think is a good idea, and we should be looking at it and how do we institutionalize that and create it for ourselves, I think is a good idea. So I'll close today, hopefully inviting more detailed conversations on each of these bills as to kind of the nuts and bolts of how we actually get to the intent. But again, reinforcing that I'm fully supportive of the intent of the bills. I lastly want to reiterate at the risk of boring Representative Smith, because he heard this from me for 8 straight days in front of General Government Ways and Means. One of the real challenges which Representative Harker pounded on, I think, that is how does the executive branch and the legislative branch collaborate more effectively, not only on the oversight, but on the provision of these services internal to state government. I will tell you my now 23 months of experience here, one of my big frustrations is I can figure out how to manage this thing, but you're the board of directors. And we've got to figure out in the executive branch, how do we collaborate more closely on an ongoing basis, not just when you're in town for session, with our board of directors around some of these really complex issues and ones that are very dynamic, especially information technology changing very rapidly, and stay ahead of that curve, actually get ahead, then stay ahead of that curve. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Jordan. I appreciate you coming and laying the executive branch lay of the land out there for us for these bills, because I am very excited about putting a couple of these pieces together and getting that collaboration going in a much faster pace than we have in the past, because I think we all sense the urgency of addressing this issue.
Yes, sir.
So I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I have two more, or maybe three more, testifiers on these group of bills, and then we're going to, after that, go into House Bill 3160 and House Bill 2525 picking up from last week. So up next on these bills, Noel Maggie, Stacy Cowan, and Jim Craven.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While they're coming up, what Michael Jordan just said about this collaboration between executive and legislative branch, maybe a good thing to do would be to have from both chambers legislators who have knowledge, experience, and interest to kind of represent us. This is not a partisan matter. This is about, I mean, I'd be happy to have Vega Peterson and Harker be our representatives from the House, because the expertise that they have could help move this along. Because for the executive branch to move ahead on their own merely means they'll get resistance from the legislature, because we don't know what they've done or why they've done it.
Yeah.
But if we could, would
where
coordinate it, then we would hear back both in the House and the Senate and be more supportive of where we want to go.
I absolutely agree. I think hopefully that's the direction we're trying to go. Good afternoon, welcome, and if you introduce yourself for the record, and give us your short and concise testimony, as one of my colleagues used to say all the time.
Short and concise. Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Noel McGee. I'm an application development team lead at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and a member of SEIU. I have over 25 years of IT experience in private industry, and I've been with ODFW for the last 2 years. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3360.
Thank you.
As amended. The language of the bill is placeholder and was meant to be replaced. I believe you have the amended text that we have submitted to you. The goal of the legislation is to require the Department of Administrative Services to establish an Office of Shared Technology Services to serve agencies in two distinct ways. The first is to provide oversight and guidance for small to medium-sized agencies through more informed analysis of agency IT problems and challenges, better decisions on potential solutions, cost-effective and efficient acquisition of products and services, and oversight of acquisition, development, implementation, and management of information technology projects. There have been a number of examples over the years of failed state IT projects. This January, I read in the Oregonian, they reported that the Board of Accountancy spent a quarter of their annual budget on a failed online licensing program. Proper oversight for a board like this would have helped to avoid this costly mistake, not to mention the immeasurable bad PR. The second way such an office as this would serve state agencies is by providing a cost-effective alternative to expensive contracting out of IT services. In SEIU's 2011 report, Moving Oregon Forward, it was reported that managers for the state of Oregon estimated that on average performing IT work in-house costs only 68.9% of what it costs to contract it out. Creating this office and staffing it with highly skilled experts from existing information technology positions in state government would allow them to respond to a variety of agency needs. This office should have expertise in acquiring and developing new technologies, architecture, project management, and contracting with private vendors. Fundamental to the success of this office will be the continued training and education of the staff to keep them abreast of the most current and cost-effective technologies, one of the hardest things to do in this business. This office will allow agencies to avoid some of the costly contracting out that happens in state government, while at the same time receiving the highest quality service and expertise. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And Stacy, you have something to say?
No prepared comments, thankfully. I just wanted an opportunity to thank Representative Vega Peterson for working.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Stacy Cowan with SEIU. Just wanted an opportunity to thank Representative Vega Peterson for working with us on this legislation. We've had an opportunity to also work with Gary Weeks. Gary was unable to be here today and asked that we submit something in writing, so you have that before you. So that's all.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing Tech America. Tech America is the nation's largest trade association representing the technology industry. I'm just here today to thank the committee for paying attention to this issue and thank the passion from Representative Vega Peterson and Representative Harker, and I think the willingness to explore and be open to change that you heard from Mr. Jordan. I think those are all positive signs as we move forward in creating a more robust and nimble technology capability in the state. Let me just close by saying our industry actually sponsored a bill in 2007 in California. You would think by 2007 California would have had a CIO, but they didn't. And our member companies, certainly from a seller's point of view, California represents an enormous market for the products and services that we provide. We were not seeing the same, we were not seeing this coordination and nimbleness. So we actually ran a bill in California under Governor Schwarzenegger. He appointed the California first CIO in, I think, January 2008. That position now is known as Secretary of Technology for the state of California, and that person, the second person, now runs the California Technology Agency. So it's I can't speak to how it's all working out down in California, but I do know the first person who took that job on behalf of the governor, Terry DeKai, left California. She is now in charge of IT systems for the Department of Defense. So I hopefully they picked a quality person who is now trying to unscramble one of the largest IT structures in the world. So anyway, just to add our appreciation to this, and that there are lots of companies here in Oregon that would probably be willing, more than willing, to help out in these endeavors.
Thank you very much. That was a great testimony. Mm-hmm. Any questions for this panel? I look forward to the continuing dialogue, and hopefully we can do something incremental here that will keep us moving forward or in a faster pace. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Sure.
So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3258 and House Bill 3328, House Bill 3329, and House Bill 3360. And up next, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3160 and House Bill 2525. And Bob, would you remind us what those two bills are? These were carried over from last week.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3160 eliminates the exclusion of insurance from the definition of real estate goods or services subject to penalties for unlawful trade practices. It includes insurance for purposes other than personal, family, or household purposes in that definition, makes technical language changes, and declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you, Sam. So up first, I think they might have been last week, but they're first this time. Justin Delaney, Larry Frank, and John Mangan. Good afternoon, gentlemen, and thank you very much for attending today, or coming back, because I think you were all three here last week. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that, and you can speak specifically to one bill or both bills at the same time, whatever you'd like to do. You just want to identify which one you're speaking about, if you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. We're a national trade group of 300 life insurance companies, most of whom do business in Oregon. Standard, Farmers, State Farm, Allstate are examples of companies that are members. And today I would like to speak to both bills and give you just some general background on the system of regulation as it applies to life companies and why we believe these bills are going to increase costs and we believe are not necessary in order to keep this system running as it has been. I speak from some experience. I've had about 25 years in regulatory affairs for the life insurance industry. And I believe the system is one of the most rigorous and detailed regulation systems that applies to any industry. Virtually everything we do, from the words in our contracts to all of our actions, are subject to scrutiny, regulation, and correction. And the goal of that regulatory system is really three things. One, to give consumers access to a wide variety of helpful products in the marketplace, to make sure that they're affordable, and to make sure that there's integrity and fairness in the system so that people will trust us and trust the system. And by those measurements, we believe the system has been highly successful and highly efficient over many decades. I'll try to give you just a little evidence before I turn it over to Standard. We have about 1.1 million life insurance contracts currently in effect in Oregon. And in 2011 alone, we paid out $4.8 billion in benefits. Those are big numbers. And they're meaningful because in all of that broad activity, the number of complaints generated in our industry is relatively extremely small. However, each one of those complaints is important and must be resolved. And the system as it exists now, with our state regulators and our consumers who are looking for a trustworthy environment, we're under heavy pressure to resolve each and every one of those complaints as rapidly as we can and as fully as we can. And if we don't, the commissioner in Oregon and in other states has broad authority and a whole set of tools to make sure that we do that. They can cause us to resolve any individual complaint or case that comes before us. If we don't do that, they can sanction us. They can take away our license. And if we don't take care of the consumer, of course, we are subject to litigation. And if we don't do the right thing, we're going to lose those cases. But the fact is, again, that we've had an excellent track record over these many decades. We think these two bills will actually increase costs to our industry, and that means to our consumers. And in our case, there's a unique impact, and that is that the pricing of life insurance is set at the time a contract is sold. So virtually all of our contracts are sold with a guaranteed price. And they're in effect for 10 or 20 or 30 or even 40 years that you may hold that life insurance contract or that retirement plan. So we don't have the option of passing along new costs to customers, existing customers. The price pressure will all come on new consumers who are coming into the market. We think that's going to reduce consumers' access to these valuable products and raise the costs that they pay. And for those reasons, we would ask you to look very carefully at these bills, and we urge you not to adopt them. And with that, I turn it over to our member company at Standard.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, record, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Justin Delaney. I'm Vice President and Associate Counsel at Standard Insurance Company. And thank you for the opportunity to come back today. At first, I have to apologize for my allergies. I was outside coaching baseball all night last night and then coming through the grass farms today. It was the final straw. So if I sneeze, I apologize in advance. Standard, as many of you know, is a 107-year-old company headquartered in Oregon. We're one of the Oregon success stories. Today we employ 2,000 Oregonians at very high wage jobs, and we bring in net economic impact over $700 million to the state of Oregon a year. We're very proud of that. We're very proud of our Oregon roots. We also derive almost all of our revenue from outside of Oregon. These aren't Oregon revenues that we're moving around in a circle. We bring in 95%+ of our business from out of state. During the testimony earlier on this bill, there was a lot of discussion about whether insurance should or should not be inside the Unfair Trade Practices Act in Oregon. And I wanted to tell you that I think that that's the wrong question. The question here, and why the Standard has opposed this type of legislation four times, is the remedies that this type of legislation would bring into the insurance system in Oregon. Taken collectively, these bills and the Senate bills that attempt to do the same thing provide things like class action lawsuits for bad faith conduct, punitive damages, attorney's fees. This collection of remedies does not exist in any other state, save perhaps West Virginia, and my colleague will talk a little bit more on that. The debate is not whether or not insurance goes in the UTPA, it's what are the remedies available to consumers. 3160 in particular, I would like to comment on. That's the bill that would put insurance into the standalone UTPA. I'd simply ask on that point, which regulator's on first? If we have the Attorney General and the Insurance Division overseeing our operations, that could be quite confusing, both for us and for the regulators. I also want to draw attention to the fact that these types of remedies will be a magnet for litigation from out-of-state residents in Oregon. As I said earlier, Standard's business is mostly outside of Oregon. You can bet plaintiffs' lawyers and their customers will file suit in Oregon under these types of remedies. Oregon's existing Insurance Trade Practices Act, it's in ORS 746, already prohibits bad faith conduct by insurers. The Unfair Trade Practices Act provides a cause of action for bad faith, whatever you want to call it. What we've talked about on the Senate side in the prior hearing is that ORS 746 is based on a national model act created by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. That act expressly and explicitly does not include a private cause of action. It was judged to be inconsistent with this very broad regulatory framework that Mr. Mangan just described. Finally, I wanted to talk about how a bad faith type of lawsuit would work in effect. It's easy to ding insurers and say, if you act bad, you ought to get sued, and I'm not going to disagree with that. But what we're talking about here in a bad faith lawsuit is a separate cause of action from a claim under the contract. Insurance is a contract, whether it's life insurance or an annuity or whatever it may be. If we pay that contract, our obligation is over, unless there's some sort of issue with the regulator, and they are always welcome on our premises, and they do come regularly. But if we pay that contract, and a plaintiff's lawyer and a client decide they want more, they can file a separate lawsuit seeking compensation above and beyond what we sold to that customer, above and beyond what we priced for. It's outside of the bargain, it's outside of the insurance deal. Finally, in conclusion, I wanted to mention again, this is the fourth time we've been here in this legislative body, not this committee, but in the Oregon legislature, to defeat this kind of bad legislation. We think it's bad public policy, but of course you expect an insurance company to say that. Ted Kulongoski also thought this was bad public policy. That's been provided to you in a binder. Corey Streisinger, Teresa Miller, prior heads of DCBS and the insurance division. I'm not going to go so far as to say they opposed it, but they certainly were not in support of this, and they were on the record about that. That's in your binder as well. I ask that you really think about this and consider the ramifications for the insurance industry and for the downstream effects this will cause on consumers in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself to the record, please?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Larry Frank. I'm a vice president and associate counsel with Standard Insurance Company. I've been with the company for 25 years. I'd first like to talk about House Bill 2525, which seeks to make available private right of action under Chapter 746, which is the Insurance Prohibited Trade Practices. We've looked at 12 Western states so far, and only four allow this kind of action under that statute. With respect to the General Business Unfair Trade Practices Act, or that under Chapter 646, we've again looked at 12 Western states and Texas, and only three have insurance included in the UTPA. So both these bills represent minority positions in all the states. Standard Insurance sells insurance to Oregonians and across the United States. We sell individual disability insurance, group life insurance, group disability insurance, and group dental insurance. If you have a file or a claim where we made the correct decision or it's reasonable, in jurisdictions that permit these kinds of remedies, we're going to pay more in terms of settling or resolving those cases or defending those cases. I have been involved in one way or another managing the company's litigation over those 25 years, and that is a fact. It is more expensive to do business in states that have these kinds of remedies. And in the group insurance context, when we settle a suit and pay claims, we pay a judgment, those costs are directly charged back to that group, that employer, as a cost of doing business and reflected in their experience. And it is that experience that drives rates at time sale and renewal. So it is more expensive, and it will be more expensive if these bills proceed. And if you have any questions, I'll try my best to answer them.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Representative Richardson.
A couple questions. Where can we get some kind of comparison on rates to show that Oregon rates are so much less than the states that allow this kind of action to be brought?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, as I mentioned in my testimony, I don't know how we can get that to you. We're not in the health insurance business, and I understand that most of the attention has been directed at health insurance and property casualty. To do a state-by-state comparison, you would have to strip out states that have inconsistent remedies available. What we are working on with some of our peer companies for you and the rest of the legislature right now is a comparison of states and exactly what remedies are available under insurance. Anecdotally, we can get you rates. In fact, today in the Salem paper, there was a piece about Oregon being extremely low cost in the automobile insurance segment. I don't have any personal knowledge about that, but it's in your paper here today.
Mr. Chair, just as a comment, the bill that we're reflecting on and considering affects many insurance carriers, and having worked in insurance industry for 30 years, Standard Insurance has an excellent reputation. Not all carriers have that kind of reputation, and those with the worst reputation are not before us claiming that they would be stung by giving consumers the right to bring an action against them for bad acts. So, but certainly none against this carrier.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, may I add something, please? Representative Richardson, I appreciate that comment, and we feel the same. We bend over backwards to take care of our customers because most of our business is group insurance, and you can bet those group employers will leave us for a competitor in a heartbeat. I understand there are insurance companies that people have a problem with. That's what I said at the start of my testimony. What I hope to impress upon you is that based on our location, Standard's location and headquarters here in Oregon, it would disproportionately impact us because we're inviting people from around the nation to file suit in Oregon under these types of statutes. This doesn't get at Allstate and State Farm and MetLife in the way it would hit Standard.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin, tell me about the role of the Oregon Insurance Division within your ongoing business and so forth. Are they involved in this, let's say, push for greater oversight, greater regulation, and so forth, or do they have a position on this issue that's before us?
Chair Holvey, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. I can't speak on behalf of the Oregon Insurance Division. I'm not aware of any insurance commissioner in my almost 20-year tenure that has asked for this type of remedy scheme. But again, I can't talk on behalf of Lou Savage or Mr. Allen at DCBS.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, thank you, everyone. You had talked about 4 out of 25 states that you had surveyed, and then 3 out of 12. Why did you pick those numbers? Are those the states in which you offer a certain kind of insurance? Why not all 50? Let us know what's happening in all 50.
We haven't had the time to do it yet. But we thought we'd start with 12 Western states. There had been some testimony that the vast majority of states have insurance either in their UTPA or have created a private right of action under Chapter 746. That's just not true. just based on my experience, it's the overwhelming majorities of states across the country do not permit a private right of action under 746. We just did some initial research and concentrated on the West. But I wouldn't suspect that our findings are going to be much different.
Okay. Two more quick questions, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So you've said that there's other regulations. It's a highly regulated industry. What is the recourse that people have if they feel like they've been wrongfully served by their insurance policy?
In Oregon, they can sue us for breach of a contract and seek to get their benefits payable. That's the remedy, at least with respect to our business, the group life and health business.
If I may, Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, the first step for most aggrieved insurance customers is the insurance division. As you probably know, we pay a fleet of consumer advocates, the state does, within the insurance division. My office at Standard receives every one of those complaints that comes in from the insurance division and from every state across the country. You can bet insurers pay attention to those. Let me tell you what happens if you don't, and if you don't resolve a complaint to the satisfaction of an insurance division. You get referred over to their market conduct team. Market conduct examinations occur sometimes at regular intervals, but most frequently when an insurance division suspects something wrong is going on, a pattern or a practice. They send a team of examiners to your company. You provide them free room and board and airline tickets, and these exams can last for up to half a year. They stay on your site, they look through your claims, through your contracts, they interview your employees. They have teeth, the consumer advocates, and it's free to the customer.
Okay, one last question, real quick. So it's hard to compare our insurance costs to others. For instance, in the auto industry, it might be that we have lower driving limits, mileage limits. So I can see how it's hard to compare to other states. But do you have any data that says in states where you operate after this has been implemented, what has happened to cost?
Representative Kenny Geyer, I'm not aware of any such data. And again, because the host of remedies that we're talking about here before the legislative body in Oregon don't exist elsewhere in America, we wouldn't be able to provide you an apples-to-apples comparison. I will try to get you some data, and I will provide that article that I saw in the Salem Statesman Journal today. There was also data from the state of Washington, which adopted one narrow piece of what's being sought by this legislation. They allow a first-party bad faith lawsuit up there with damage caps. And if my memory serves me correctly, there was a 10 to 11% increase in homeowners' claims immediately on the heels of that law being adopted in Washington. Can you prove cause and effect? No, but it's more than a coincidence.
Representative Doherty.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but when we had the hearing earlier, there were quite a few people that came in, testified of the problems that they had with the insurance companies. Why is the insurance industry the only one not under unfair trade practices?
Chair,
so many others are.
Yes. Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, that's an excellent question. And I'll get back to this National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act that I referenced. That is the model on which Oregon's insurance regulatory framework is based. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, when they created that model act, debated and explicitly decided that it was inappropriate to insert a private cause of action for breach under this type of regulatory scheme. So my response to the folks who testified was that insurance wasn't intentionally excluded. It was never intended to be included in a separate Unfair Trade Practices Act because, again, we have a Claims Fair Practices Act inside ORS 746.
If I follow it. So if I'm poor, what do I do? if I'm poor and I was not serviced by the company that I've been paying money to, what do I do?
Sure. Representative Doherty, first you get free assistance from your insurance division. In most states in which we operate, when we deny or limit a benefit, we have to tell that consumer how to access that free help from the insurance division. Second, you get an attorney that will take it on retainer or take a portion of whatever is recovered, and you sue under the contract like most other lawsuits under contractual services in America are filed.
Okay, good. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really sympathetic to Representative Doherty's question. I understand a contract is a contract, and I strongly agree with that. But there's also a reality, and I'm looking at three guys in front of me with their suits and their ties on with advanced educations protecting their company. That's what you're supposed to do, your association. That's what you're supposed to do. I get that. But there's a lot of folks out there who don't have a knowledge of where they can turn to address these issues, and I'm sympathetic to that as well. And I guess the reason I raise this, Chair, is I wonder if it'd be possible, and I don't know your intent on this bill, but to hear from the insurance division and how they handle these issues as they come forward. And I'll just share with you very quickly. I had a personal situation in which I was in an argument with my insurance company over $450. And I knew I was right. They knew they were right. But you know what? It's kind of funny. Once they found out who I was, the issue got resolved real quick. But other folks on the street don't have that option.
And Representative Smith, it is my intent to have the insurance division before we finish with these bills. I wanted to get testimony from the opponents, and eventually we'll have the insurance division come.
And I appreciate that. And guys, I get what you're saying. A contract's a contract. Yeah. I believe that. Yeah. I just want to know how do these issues get resolved.
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Chair, can I add one comment in response to those two questions, because I think they're excellent questions. Yeah. And that is that the nature of the system is that because we are covering such a broad swath of the population, because the system is so large and affects virtually every person in the state, there has to be an efficient, predictable, rational way to deal with the whole system as it stands. And that's why so much authority is vested in the insurance commissioner's office and why they have such broad powers. And Representative Doherty, to answer your question, the commissioner steps in for the consumer in every case. So if he finds that a consumer's been wronged, he will step in, he will bring us to a hearing, he can take our license away, he can stop the bad actor from taking that practice, and he can force us actually to fulfill the contract on the spot. And if we don't do that, he can put us out of business. He has that power as sort of a substitute for this more random approach of litigation case by case. And it's important to the system.
I really appreciate your testimony. But I think, some of our concerns have been raised. We did have testimony from a potato farmer who was put out of business after 4 years of wrangling through the courts, and Ms. Seidel with her company again, another business, and then a person from Astoria who couldn't get his benefits paid, and yet those things weren't able to be solved, and they were drug out over years and years and years, where those companies and people are economically harmed. And what do they get at the end of the day? And I want to move on with the rest of our testimony.
Can I have just one real quick follow-up, because it dealt with, if you don't agree with the insurance commissioner, do you have any recourse? If you think that their facts aren't there, and do you have any recourse, legal recourse?
You mean, Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, you mean the insurance company?
Yes.
Most of the severe sanctions the commissioner can place on you, such as the large fines or the actual licensure withdrawal, would be subject to public hearing. So we would have a chance to make our case, and the commissioner would make a judgment.
Okay,
thank you. Up next, I have Keith Banovich. And committee, it looks like the other bills on our agenda are all going to get carried over as we finish this up. So we'll be carrying over the rest of the bills. Welcome.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm an attorney in private practice, and you may remember me as being Associate Attorney General. I appeared before you many times, and I look forward to speaking with you again today. I am here speaking in favor of 3160 and 2525, and let me tell you why. Before I joined the Department of Justice about 4 or 5 years ago, I represented an Oregon company, and they had a theft of inventory, substantial amount of money, $10,000, $20,000 in inventory. It wasn't a real big company, but, you know, it was real money to them. They made a claim to their carrier. The carrier denied it. The client came to me and said, geez, can you take a look at it? I investigated it, looked at it. I felt they had a good claim. And then they said, could you help us? And I said, sure. And I gave them a budget for what it was going to cost to sue the insurance company. And they unfortunately decided not to go forward because they couldn't afford to pay me since they no longer had the inventory to sell. So that was an example with what I thought was a very legitimate claim that was not pursued because the company had the stronger hand. I'm presently working with some folks who are trying to get coverage for their children for autism. And at least as I read the law, you folks passed a bill 4 or 5 years ago that said if you write an insurance policy in this state that provides health insurance, you have to provide coverage for children with autism. Nonetheless, these folks have been repeatedly denied any kind of care for their children. The problem is that there's no ready tool for me to do anything. You can't bring a claim under the insurance code. You cannot bring a claim under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And unfortunately, from time to time, I've had to turn to some of these parents and say, I'm sorry, I just simply cannot help you. And so they're stuck with their children not being able to get care for what is clearly a problem that can be treated and can be treated promptly and resolved. But they can't get that care because they can't afford it. So Representative Doherty asked about what the process is for somebody that wants to complain about the treatment they've received from their insurance company. And as was discussed, you can report it to the insurance commissioner. And they do as good a job as they can, but the reality is, in today's short and tight budgets, they're limited in their ability to do things. They cannot force the insurance company to pay a claim. They're a licensure-type entity. And so DCBS would be able to investigate licenses, maybe fine the company, but they can't force a company to pay. That can only be brought as a result of a contract action against the insurance company in this state. Now, what's problematic is literally if you go across the border to Washington, the exact same kind of homeowner, car owner would have a very different scenario. They would have an ability to go after their insurance company other than on a contract type basis. So, sadly, if you lived in Vancouver, you would be able to pursue a claim against the insurance company, unlike here in Oregon. As I understand the two bills before you, they don't create any new regulations. Insurance companies are unique in the sense that they are not regulated by the federal government. They are regulated only by states. And the bills before you, as I read them, don't create any new regulation. What they do is they simply allow a private individual to pursue a statutory claim against an insurance company. That's all these bills do. And in effect, the insurance companies will now be treated like banks and debt collectors and virtually every other business in the state of Oregon. And over the past 3 or 4 sessions, you folks have decided to expand the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to include banks and to include debt collectors. And at least in my view, insurance companies should be held accountable just like banks and debt collectors. So I know you're short on time. I'll conclude my testimony by recommending that you schedule this for a vote and vote in favor of it.
So a quick question from me. Thank you for your testimony. So why doesn't suing an insurance company for a breach of contract provide the remedy to the consumer that we're we're hearing about, and you know, because we've been told that is the consumer's remedy in the state of Oregon, essentially.
There are a couple of problems with it. First, and to be honest, lawyers are not cheap, and I could barely afford a lawyer if I wanted to sue my insurance company. So I would have to figure out some way to pay my lawyer to pursue the claim. And because a lot of these claims are not of a large dollar amount, no lawyer would take it on a contingent fee basis, because you would probably invest more time and money investigating the case and pursuing it than you could possibly recover. So, for example, if you had a theft of your car or your house burned, you know, you probably can't earn enough as a lawyer to take that case on a contingent fee basis. So the individual homeowner or car owner would have to come up with money to pay the lawyer on an hourly basis. And second of all, because the court process is fairly lengthy, you can go an extended period of time before ever getting any kind of recovery whatsoever on a contract-type basis. And in the meantime, you've been without the use of your car or a treatment for your child, and there's no additional benefit to you in a contract. All you do is get the claim paid, and that's it. So there's basically no incentive for the insurance company to resolve the case early on. Because the worst case scenario for them is they pay 100 cents of the claim that they were obligated to pay at the front end. So that's the way the situation works, and why, you know, you don't see a lot of claims brought against insurance companies here in Oregon.
Representative Richardson.
I have a question for Mr. Dibinovich.
Yes, sir.
As I understand it, there would be a private cause of action from private attorneys as well as from the Attorney General's office. I mean, the AG could represent. Is that correct? Are you aware?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Richardson. I think it depends on which bill we're looking at. I can't speak for the Attorney General, so I don't know what her position is on it. I can only speak from my experience, which is that when an industry is in an area that's already regulated, such as banks or debt collectors, the Department of Justice generally deferred to the regulator for any regulatory actions or licensure actions. And it was in the rare circumstance where a company was way out of line that the two agencies would generally collaborate and work together in pursuing a matter.
Okay, just a quick follow-up question. I guess what I'm wondering is if insurance companies are concerned about an increase in claims against them, and I guess I don't know if those claims would be from private attorneys or from the Attorney General's office representing claimants under the UTPA. And so I just was kind of wondering whether or not it would make any sense to have it not be a government response, but that there would be a cause of action for the person under this, but not through a government representation, but through private representation.
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Richardson, I believe the insurance commissioner already has some regulatory authority, obviously, under the insurance code. So giving a private right of action wouldn't increase the insurance commissioner's authority. The question would be, would the Department of Justice have any increased authority? And I think that would be something that the two agencies could work out. I mean, there may be circumstances where DOJ would need to assist the insurance commissioner in pursuing a licensure revocation. But that already exists, to the best of my knowledge.
Okay, I was actually referring to a private cause of action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Is it always either the AG or a private attorney, or is it ever one or the other? And I just don't have any experience there.
Chair Holby, Representative Richardson, there are situations where you could have two parallel claims. The department doesn't represent an individual, so the individual will recover their own damages. The department would be representing the state of Oregon and seeking the statutory penalties under the UTPA that are different.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Other quick questions? I got time for not seeing any questions. Yeah, I really appreciate you coming forward and providing us the another opinion on these bills. Thank you very much. With that committee, I want to make sure that we are carrying over House Bill 3080. House Bill 3035, House Bill 2370,
House Bill 2381. And I think we're going to reschedule 2931.
These guys look like lawyers.
Will we be done ready? We'll go ahead and carry over 2931 as well. So thank you very much. Any other business, Bob? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3160 and close it. Or close the public hearing on House Bill 2525 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.